is knowing.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 609. Jason Lindgren is with me, and Stephen Oliver joins us for the first time. We're going to start out by talking a little bit about the creation story. We may get into many different topics. We're going to see where this goes. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a surprisingly warm and lovely good morning.
Do we have anything to announce, or can we get right in? I feel like I'm forgetting to announce something.
I think we can get right in.
Okay. All right. If you say so. All right. Welcome, Stephen.
Oh, welcome. Thank you, Crow and Jason, for having me.
All right. Would you like to give any information out at all to the audience before we get started? If you give an email, this is hour one, which means a lot of people could send emails, but you could give out web address or anything else, or would you like to just jump in?
I guess if people are interested in more information, they could go to the Meditation Association. The NSTCMA is a Facebook address that people can go to, and they can reach me there if they want.
I'm sorry, one more time.
NSTCMA.
All right, .MA?
No, that's Facebook.
Oh, okay, sorry. A little slow on the uptake. All right, so you kind of have a history in meditation and spiritual endeavors, is that correct?
Right on. I was born into a family of spiritual healers. And to me, it was just normal that everyone lived like that and people talked about spirit and energy and things like that.
Yeah, I think in the West that most of us think that that's something that goes on with a different part of the world. But I think people should look back because Christianity, which is primarily what most people in this part of the world are exposed to, in their spiritual life, they had a lot of meditation and other things. That's maybe what the vows of silence were about, the old tales of the monks in cells. There was actually quite a bit of meditation in the Western traditions, which seems to have fallen off over the years. But let's jump in here. Let's pick up with ideas around the creation story, and it's all you.
Oh, okay. Well, when I was quite young, my parents, being a Christian orientation, they talked about the resurrection a lot. And then later on, as I got into more Eastern philosophy and studying things, I bumped into this creation story. And I didn't really initially see the connection between what we think of at this time of year, the resurrection, the birth, and then later on, the death, as being this basically the same story. And I use that story a lot with different groups of people I work with in different forms, but it's all the same story about birth, struggle, death, and being reborn kind of thing.
You know, it has been my experience doing this podcast that in the part of the world where I live in, people have been kind of taught to take a dim view on other experiences. And what I have noticed, or what I discovered coming up, was that all truth resides in the creation, in nature. It doesn't just reside there, it's proven there. And we don't make truth. But in all these stories and spiritual traditions, you notice it's the same idea with different characters, different personages, different languages. But basically, as an example, the importance of three comes up everywhere in the world, in almost every religious tradition.
Yep.
And I think it's important that people fan out and get a good look at other parts of the world. And what's that old saying by Twain? Something about travel being fatal to bigotry. And I think that applies here. I don't know what your take is on it.
Well, in preparation for our conversation, I started looking back and thinking about, well, where did I get this creation story and how come I use it a lot? And it struck me, the obvious thing that I never really considered until actually this week, was that all of my instructors and influencers never wrote anything down. They never put anything in writing. It was all either an experience or a story. And I'm beginning to believe that these stories are symbolic ways of getting this information to us that isn't spoiled. I don't mean this in a negative way, but spoiled by words. I think words are too concrete. So when someone asks me how to do something, I try not to tell them anything, because if I say it specifically, it becomes a concrete thing. But if I tell them a story, if I make it a joke, or if I make it a, some kind of loose symbolic thing that they can then add their own meaning to, they'll accept it easier.
I like that idea, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And this is what I found all through my life and working from with young children to adolescents to seniors, that if I came directly at them with what I wanted them to do, they would probably not, either not understand it or reject it. But if I just told them a story, they would relax, the shoulders would drop, and they would take it in. I think we like stories. I think stories are an excellent way of getting deeper information in without us immediately rejecting it.
I think people receive it differently. Like if you're giving someone instruction, they may be left-brained or right-brained, you know, whatever is being directed to them. But when you tell a story, the imagination kicks in. And that is critically important. In almost all spiritual traditions where there is a spiritual upliftment or an enlightenment of some sort, quite often the last steps are imagination. And right in the front of that word, we have the image thing. And I bumped into a thing that I think I'll mention here. It's kind of strange. You tell people stories to engage them. But check this out. I just heard this. Apparently, all people don't imagine in the same way. And here's the example that was put forward. Can you imagine yourself holding a blue ball? Is that easy for you to do? You too, Jason. Can you easily imagine yourself holding a blue ball in your hand?
Yes.
Well, relatively easy, yeah. Yep, I
okay.
Had to pause.
So once you've done that, can you imagine the blue ball turning pink?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Easily, right?
Yes.
So can you imagine yourself taking the pink ball and throwing it and having it turn red while it's flying through the air?
Yep.
Yep.
So here's the thing. Apparently, there's a, I don't know what portion, but a significant portion of people that only make it to the ball in the hand changing color. And beyond that, they don't have the ability, apparently, which has been shown, to imagine the rest of what I just said. And this is critical in what you're saying, because I think it plays into what you're saying. If people are directed with words their whole life, it's a completely different ball game than being told a story and engaging the imagination. And that kind of reminds me of why the Bible used parables, or Jesus used parables. It's a similar thing.
I agree. The other half of that is that a few years ago, I heard a researcher talking about the fact that they interviewed a number of university students, and they were shocked at how few of them had self-dialogue. They didn't know what that was. And a lot of people that I work with, I call them like beginners, people just discovering about these alternative things, a lot of them don't have self-dialogue.
That's critically interesting, because the moment you say that, I'm thinking, well, how do they think to do a thing? Because when I think of like doing a thing, I think of it in a self-dialogue, not all the time, but most of the time. So how do they pre-prepare whatever they're going to do?
Absolutely. And I think that those are the kinds of people, when you present them with a challenging thing, such as the imagining the ball, they can't do it, or they have difficulty doing it. And what I've done over the years, if I've used a story to loosen people up and get them doing those kinds of internal creative imagining, it's like listening to radio theater. As a kid, I used to listen to radio theater a lot, and that was fantastic because I got to imagine as the person spoke. And that's what I think what we're kind of talking about, is that you get someone adding their internal dialogue to what you're saying.
I almost wonder if the modern era has contributed to the lack of dialogue with all the digital tools. You know, basically the storytelling in our part of the world has kind of been hijacked by places like Hollywood. And when you're told a story, like take, you know, one of the action hero movie stories, there's absolutely no thought required. It's about the flash. It's about the speed, the explosions, the excitement. There is almost no need to engage imagination or creative thinking or problem solving at any level. Whereas if you go back to, say, a much, much older movie where there's a subplot and a sub-subplot, it's a different thing. But if you look at the storytelling in the Western world now, it's primarily through media. For the most part, it's bereft of subplots and sub-subplots.
Yeah, I think, and again, this is a lot of the stuff I've been thinking about in preparation for our chit-chat, is that we're talking about consciousness. And I believe that the creation story is the first story about the development or the self-awareness changing into consciousness. I think, you know, what do they call them? NPCs, people walking around, they're aware, but they're not conscious.
Probably no self-dialogue, probably can't imagine the ball beyond changing its color.
That's what I believe as well, that people who are very aware, but are not able to have a conscious conversation with themselves and with their environment and with others. They take things as they are, their followers perhaps. And maybe that when we talk about waking people up, we're getting them to have that dialogue with themselves and with nature and with each other. So that's where I'm coming from with the creation story.
You know, it almost sounds, when we talk about NPCs, to me, that seems like it's a product of social engineering. In other words, I imagine it's probably always been individuals that could fit that description throughout our past, but I would be willing to bet there's a lot more of them now. What do you think brings this on? Why do you think that this is so prevalent now?
Well, my belief that I've sort of been developing is that consciousness is not a given. That you have to work for consciousness. And the technology that we are quickly adopting, I think, flattens consciousness. I don't think you can have a conscious relationship with a computer or with a cell phone. You can with a person, you can with nature, but I don't think you can have it with an inanimate object such as a computer. I think it flattens our consciousness.
I would actually add, from my point of view, it retards it.
Well, yeah.
I think it's more severe than that. And I think it's by design as well. I think these things are control mechanisms that have been cleverly implemented in a way that gets us to agree into it. And there's your key. It's not foisted on you per se. You're being put in a situation where numerically they know the odds are in their favor and that more people will accept it than won't. And once it's accepted, we see the Overton window start moving to the right. I mean, I'm with you all the way, although I would absolutely say retarded as opposed to flattened, because I think the result is a little more severe.
Well, in my classes, I usually turn to an individual and look right at them and say, what do you feel? You know, we're doing something, doing these movements. I say, what do you feel? And they can't reply. They just look at me with a blank look. Why are you asking me? Because they can't interpret that. They can't explain what they are feeling. And I think that's where we're going with AI, is that it has the symbols, it has all the outward appearance of being conscious. They say, well, you know, AI is becoming conscious. And I definitely do not believe that. I think it's taking us into an unconscious state.
AI is automated. It will never be conscious by the definition that I accept for consciousness. For me to accept consciousness, it has to fit the old alchemical definition of spirit, body, and soul. But, you know, it occurred to me, Stephen, did you catch the episode we did on the movie Revolver?
No, I don't think so.
So the whole thing is basically, the whole movie is shaped around ego. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because it occurs to me, if someone does not have self-dialogue, does that mean that they don't have the same problem overcoming ego? Or does it mean something completely in the other direction? In the movie we broke down, there's a scene in the elevator where the main protagonist is trying to overcome the fact that he has realized the voice in his head is not him. It's his ego, basically, or the devil, or you can give it any label or any name you want. And he takes control at that point and informs him, I'm in control. You work for me.
Oh.
That is the premise for the whole movie. But the reason I'm bringing this up is the number of times we've talked about waking up in the morning with a song in your head you can't turn off. And what I'm wondering is, if you don't have self-dialogue, how does that portrayal of the ego even apply? Or for that matter, if you don't have self-dialogue, do you even have songs in your head that you can't control ever? I'm just wondering.
Oh, wow. That's a good question. Maybe a spinoff of that is doing a meditation and watching yourself. Can people actually release their ego long enough to just listen to themselves, to just watch themselves quietly? I think that's what meditation and fasting does for you. It gives you a chance to realize that you're part of something and you're part of a process, but you have to listen. You have to stop and listen to be able to appreciate it.
In our part of the world, meditation has been defamed. To this day, they make fun of it on the most popular TV shows, saying things like, "I told you that was hokum." But here's the thing. The first time that I heard meditation described in a meaningful way that sank home with me was, the mind as you have it now is like boiling water. And when you engage in meditation, your mind at some point becomes like calm water. Then I heard, and I'm sure you've heard it endlessly, the old adage comparing meditation to a wild monkey in a tree. But what I would like to point out to anyone listening who's never really thought about it, if you did catch the Revolver episode, had Jake simply become a master meditator, he would have gained the same control that he battled for in the elevator. That is the basic main beginning point of meditation, is to calm and control your mind. And I don't know if you've heard this, Stephen, but I was reading an old, I don't remember what tradition it was from, but the first time I heard this, I couldn't believe it. It made the claim that if you don't meditate, you've never meditated. The average person, every time they take a breath, and not just take a breath, but when they change from inhaling to exhaling, a new thought pops in your head. And I thought, that's ridiculous. And then I tested it. And that's when I began to take everything very seriously, because I realized it is like a wild monkey in the tree. I breathe in, I'm thinking about hot dogs. I breathe out, I'm thinking about a car I want. I breathe in, I'm thinking about what I'm doing next week. I mean, it's literally that rampant, but we never notice because, like you said, we never take the time to be quiet and examine that.
Here's what I found out in talking with people in all different settings. Again, people who would not normally have meditated before. So I'm talking about someone new to it. And the way I would approach them is, I would say that here in the West, we accept that there is a one energy, the atom, that it's everything. So everyone will accept that normally, that a tree is made of the same material as a glass of water, as a whatever, that's, it's all one source energy. And then I would move on that in the East, they believe that too, but they also believe that this one energy is every time, so that if we could go back in time, we'd see the same energy in every time. And that it's not only everything, but every time and every place. And I can usually get everyone to agree with that concept. And it's a very Western concept, one energy, every time, every place. But where it drops off is when I say that this one energy that's everything, every time, and every place is also conscious. And people will then kind of give me that look. And I would say that that is the separation between Western and Eastern, that in the West, we don't believe that consciousness is pervasive and everywhere. We think it's only the privilege of being a human.
The scientific clinical divide you're describing, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the first step in telling the creation story is getting whomever I'm talking to just accept the fact that this energy is conscious. And that's sort of the first leap into another level of understanding, is just accepting the fact that we live in a universe where there is one energy that's conscious. And that in itself is a big jump.
It's so funny that I'm talking to you, Stephen, because, and Jason can tell you, I recently tried to start to bridge this gap. And I don't know if you're aware, but I've been focused on the sun.
Mm-hmm.
I love telescopes, and I've switched all my energies over to the sun during this age change. How long ago was it, Jason, do you suppose, when I started to say that I accept the sun is conscious?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
probably this
ago.
Year, right? Or a long time ago. I don't even remember.
It's been a little while, I would say.
But it's funny that you should say what you're saying, because when I took that tack and I tried it other ways, you know, exactly what you said, every atom has consciousness, but people were not having any of it. The scientific clinical divide would overrule that. But when I came from the sun, people did begin to consider it. Some accepted it. And what I said was, I accept that the sun is conscious, but think about this. If the sun provides so much of what we need to be alive, how can it not be alive itself to provide that? And it started to bridge the gap, believe it or not.
Well, I guess what I would do when I'd see their eyes glazing over, I'd say, well, let me tell you a story. And that's how I would then take it from me trying to get them to understand or believe that everything is conscious. I say, well, let me tell you a story. And I tell them a story about how the ancients thought everything was created. And that's how I would introduce them into that creation story. And just to very quickly do that, I'd say the ancients believed that everything was conscious, that there was a one energy that was conscious, but it hadn't developed into anything. It was just there. It hadn't formed. It was just always there, everywhere. It was conscious and it was pretty good, but it was kind of bored because it didn't see, it didn't have any company, there wasn't anything. It was just energy, this solid, white, undefined energy. And that the only way that this one energy could have fun and experience anything was to turn itself off. And it realized that if it turned itself off, right, it could then wake up and see and become a real thing. It's like looking, if you're in a space and everything was the same color, you wouldn't be able to differentiate it. But if you change one thing, you then notice it. So this one energy decided it was just going to turn itself off periodically just so that it could re-experience itself being present. And that was great. But the problem with that is that it was too quick. It was just all of a sudden there and all of a sudden not there. So there has to be a transition from when it's on to going off. So that's what created the initial phasing of going from being on to off. And of course, when you're off, there has to be a transition from being off to being on, sort of like a dimmer switch. You're on and you're going to turn the dimmer switch down till you're off. You're off and you're going to turn the dimmer switch up until you're fully on. And that's what created the four phases, from being off to turning itself on, into being on to turning itself off. And I believe that when I started studying some of the martial art forms and so on, they really only talked about four movements. And I think that that creation story gets you thinking about the fact that there really are only four things. There's off and getting ready to turn on, or in the process of turning on. And then there's on, and then the process of turning off. And the phrases that I've been taught to explain that is, when something is turning on, it's doing what they call a pen. It's penning, it's expanding. And when it reaches its full extent, it's fully expanded. If it goes any more, like a balloon, it will break. It's fully expanded. That's what we would call a loose state. It's at its top, can't go anymore, or decides not to go anymore. And then at that point, it can collapse and release its energy like a balloon breaking. And that would be like a G force. And then finally, there's that quiet one. Another example of that that I would give people once I get them thinking that way is a wave expanding like a surfer. You imagine a surfer on a wave and you watch the surfer as the wave swells up. At one point when the wave is at its maximum, the surfer will stand up on the wave and point it and wait for that exact second to fly down the face of the wave. And that's the release of it, right? They're flying down the face of the wave. And then when they hit the bottom of the wave, it's called the end. When they hit the end of it and it's all done, there's that sound that I love of the sound of the wave going back to the ocean after the wave has crashed on the beach. And there's that sound of the water going back to the ocean, that and, that's what I call the and. So I try to wheel in the four phases of life, the pen, the expanding, the lu, the at that maximum point, and then the G, the release of the energy, and then the and, where everything comes to a calm state and then begins the whole process all over again. So that's kind of how I try to wheel the story of creation into the four phases of life, the Penlujian.
So does that foundationally presuppose for the four states of matter, the ideas like later you heard earth, wind, fire, philosophical approaches to the four states of matter, which again, does that then translate out to directions like a compass?
I think so. So in the West, we have the physical, solid, liquid, gas, and ether, the energetic ether. So we have those four phases. And in the East, I think that those get translated into those four phases of expansion, that end expansion point, and then the release. And in the West, those are all associated with increased speed. So it starts with a mass being the slowest moving entity, like a solid mass, frozen solid mass. And as it speeds up, it turns to liquid, it gets faster, it turns to gas. And if it gets really fast, it turns to fire, right? And I think that's, in my mind, where we're looking at. And then, and this is something that was interesting, the four phases, right? You have Pen, Lu, Qi, and An, you have the fire at the end. And then it has to start all over again. And I think that gets into the alchemical end of it, where you end up with just the carbon at the end of it, back to like that, the matter end of it again.
Well, what we're describing is the difference between how I learned to think about things where I am, bereft of consciousness. It's what I call it, the science clinical divide. Everything is sterile. If it can't be weighed, then it really doesn't matter. These types of ideas. But when you pull back around and begin to broaden the way you think about things, it changes everything. You know, I was looking at alchemical texts and I was reading about vibration and fascinated by the idea that an alchemist could go to the garden because he wanted to make a medicine. And just that initial glance of the plant, it was like Sherlock Holmes on steroids. What could be deduced from the color, how many leaves, its vibration level, all these things that was completely lost on the world that I lived in. I never heard of anyone even once approaching to know things just from that initial glance. And so I started to practice like using the blue ball thing we just did. Mm-hmm. When I realized that vibration could account for color, I started imagining that I would hold a flower in my hand and in my mind, I would vibrate it to change the color. And the reason I did that is because I wanted to know if this flower I was looking at was a higher vibration or a lower vibration. But what we're talking about in general, those thoughts never get had in the initial way that I was taught to think in school. That process never would have arose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I was tuning in and watching. I was curious about Kundalini yoga, and I had a question, and so I was searching on the internet, and finally I found this gentleman that seemed to have been practicing for a long time, and he was going to describe all the different phases. And at one point he stopped and he said, you know, a lot of this isn't in the texts. And I began to think, and I said, well, I wonder why he would say that. And I wondered if that's true. And it occurred to me that it couldn't be put into text. So things that you're describing, the ability to have a ball in your hand and have it change colors as you throw it, there's no way that could be put into, that has to be experienced. So there's some things that I know the monk I used to work with, he would call it a transmission. He wouldn't explain it to me, but if he had me do it and he did it with me, what I picked up was that transmission or that way or that feeling of doing it that I'm not sure that it could be written down, right?
And it's also real at a level that it doesn't matter what anyone says about it, because you know, having been the experiencer, that it is undeniable. I'm sure you've heard this. Have you ever heard about some of the initiations for like Tibetan mandala meditations?
Mm-hmm.
When I first read it, it blew my mind. And it's exactly what you're saying. They set them up. They initiate them in to know what they need to know to do the mandala meditation. In some cases, there's a tanko, which is an image, basically a poster on the wall, which gives them the mandala or whatever they're going to do. But after they think they've achieved a level, they simply are asked some questions. And it's crazy. Like they'll say, how many arms did that being have? Describe the being. And if they don't describe there was a necklace, they didn't get there. But if they do describe a necklace, they're then asked how many beads were on it. And this goes on and on and on. The level of specificity and complexity is mind-boggling. And nonetheless, it is 100% experiential, because at no time were they told what they would find or anything else. They had to get there in meditation, experience it, witness it, and then report back to prove that they'd achieved.
Stephen, would you say that the experience was the same from person to person, even though it wasn't described to them how it would be?
Yes, that's the whole thing. The imagined, just say angel, since we're in the West, I'll use the word angel. The imagined angel does wear a necklace, but this is not advertised or put into art, and that necklace does have a certain amount of beads. From the point of view of a meditator experiencing, I mean, maybe Stephen knows more about this than I do. I don't know.
Well, just from my personal experience, I always wondered why the different people that I had the fortunate opportunity to work with never told me anything. And I would be kind of angry sometimes. Like, oh, geez, I go all this travel, all this distance, and I go, oh, see this, and they don't say anything, right? They don't tell me anything, right? They help me, but they don't tell me anything. And they refuse to repeat things. So if I went one time and we did a certain set of things, and I'd go another time, would never repeat anything. And they never give me an example of something twice. And I said, oh, so why are they doing that? And then it occurred to me that the power of suggestion is so strong that if I, and I noticed in working with particularly children, if I suggest it in a certain way, they'll begin to experience it that way. So what I've learned is it's better to define something or try to get people to do something without coloring it too much, to leave a lot of blank space there for them to color it in their minds, right? Otherwise, they'll just be repeating what I experienced.
Yeah.
And what my experience is my personal experience. And if I want you to experience your experience, then I really shouldn't say very much, right? I should just give you the nudge, and then it's up to you to start swimming or to start experiencing. And then it becomes your experience, not me telling you what my experience was.
You know, the most respected lineages that I'm aware of that I've read about are all handed forward through transmission, and they follow the rules of what we do in the West with a crime scene, with evidence, a chain of custody. You've got this lineage that started with an individual who's usually famous, like a Tibetan one might be Gyampopa or Milarepa or Padmasambhava. People have heard these names, many in the West, though they don't know why. And so they transmitted to someone all the way forward to the modern day, but that chain of custody of the transmission is unbroken and tracked all the way back. And when I thought about my Western view of this, the only thing I could relate it to was evidence in a crime. That's the only thing I could compare it to where that chain of custody is valued and important.
Right. That's funny. Well, you know, I guess are we talking about learning? The difference between learning and memorizing. So you can give someone a set of instructions and they can memorize them. Or if you give them the components and they learn to put them together, they might actually put them together in a unique way that you never thought of. And if we don't do it that way, if we don't encourage, say, children or people around us to be resourceful and to combine things their way, we'll never have innovation. We'll only have replication. So if we want innovation, we have to say less and allow the kids to do more, to experience more on their own. Then it becomes, as you said, it becomes theirs. If they experience it and they create it, then it's theirs.
That's a big problem we have today, is that everything's about memorize this and you get to pass and move forward, as opposed to let me give you tools to help you experience things and learn things for yourself.
Yep.
That's social engineering, right? What I experienced in school, to get an A, if I wanted an A, for the majority of my school time, I was made to memorize and regurgitate. That's what got me an A, mostly, not 100%. But what Stephen's saying is 100% correct. That's how you get carbon copies, right?
That's how you get carbon copies.
You don't get innovation. You don't get progression. You don't get unique things. And what's more is you're homogenizing that culture.
I'll give you another example. At one phase in my life, I was a professional dancer and I worked for a company here in Canada called the Toronto Dance Theater. And I was a young kid. I was in my 20s and it was all brand new to me. And I fell in love with one of the dancers. She said, "Oh, come to Toronto, Steve. You'll love it." And I was thrown in the middle of this alien world. I had no idea. But all I knew is that I loved music and I wanted to learn to dance and I loved her. So what the heck, eh? And it's a situation. The technique was called Martha Graham technique, which is very much like classical ballet. So when you go into a classroom, it's very ritualistic. I mean, there are rules for everything, how you dress, where you stand, how you move, the sequence of them. I mean, it's incredibly detailed. And so I was kind of lost and I didn't know what the heck was going on. Nobody said anything. No one told me not to do anything. No one told me where to stand, what to do. And at one point, one of the dancers said, "Look, I'll meet you afterwards and I'll show you a few things." So she took me into an empty studio and she never said a word. She just went through the routine with me once. And that was it. You had to pick it up through osmosis. And although the first week or so was awkward, all of a sudden I found that there was a dialogue, a language. And it goes even worse than that. When we started to learn to do, say, a 20-minute or a 30-minute dance piece, none of it was written down. None of it was verbally described. It was all done through body language. And much like, say, a band coming together and playing a song through improvisation, right? But so that experience with the dance studio was unbelievable in the sense that none of it was written down. None of it was actually verbal. It was all a physical experience. And I think more people need to have situations where, and maybe that's what martial art gives you, or maybe that's what playing in a band gives you, Jason. I don't know. Just a rambling thought there about the experiential learning.
That's the real world kind of test. You can ask someone, "Are you a dancer?" They can say whatever they want. But what you experienced is being asked if you're a dancer and then being told to prove it, right?
and to live it.
Yeah.
To live it.
Either you do or you don't. There is no try. Isn't that the joke?
The expression would be that you can do every move in your head. In your mind, you can do every move. But when you get on the dance floor, the reality is, can you actually do what's in your mind?
It makes you wonder. This NPC thing has me fascinated. And I truly want to know, if you don't have an inner dialogue, I mean, that makes you different in a way, or at least different from how I view things.
Well, if we go back to the idea that everything is this one energy and it's conscious, and the whole creation story of this one energy wanting to basically manifest and become real. What that took me to was the idea that if we're having a relationship with this one energy, and if we replace it with an AI, what happens to that flow? I mean, does it continue? Can a smartphone emulate that flow of energy? And I don't think so. I think that it will flatten it or kill it.
I don't see how it possibly could.
Yeah, I don't think it's meant to. We've talked about this. Jason and I have brought this up. And the way that I go at it is this. It's demonstrative through the idea of a trust. In a trust, you have a creator who's in charge and control because he created it. And then you have a beneficiary and you have a trustee. When you get into a courtroom, same thing is going on. When you experience Western religion or any religion that has the triune idea built into it, because nature proves that that is important, you have that idea, which is later demonstrative in a man-made trust. So the people that are making a run at the world right now to control everything, they can't claim control of the creation. For one, they didn't create it. For two, they can't create the things that are in it. They can't make a sun or a fish or a tadpole or a tree. So what they're doing is they're making a parallel, knockoff, metaphor, pale shadow in their digital tools. And that's what you're talking about with the AI. And from my point of view, it is absolutely not meant to succeed at the same level. It's meant to retard the success that could be had in the natural level. After all is said and done, if a spiritual advancement is critically important in the life of a human being, if that's one of the valid things we're supposed to be trying to achieve while we're alive, then you go to the digital world where they're going to start chipping heads, that would cut you off. Like in the episode image I'm making for this talk we're having now, I'm going to include the chakras on the human body, because at the base of what you and I have covered here today, it's about energy. It's about the creation. It's about what nature proves is true. And it's about vibration. It's about energy. When you cross over into the digital world, you explained the four states in this way. It's on, then it's preparing to be off, then it's off, then it's preparing to be on. Well, in the digital world, there's only two. It's on, it's off. There is no transition. There is no gradation. It's just what it is. When you take a human being that can spiritually ascend to, I mean, it's almost beyond belief what you can actually read in the records of this world of the spiritual levels people have attained. It is mind-boggling. But the digital side of that, if you opt to go that way, you're going to be cut off from what was achievable under the natural environment. That's my point of view.
I'm sort of looking at my notes, and there was one note I had made as a sort of just a little flag to myself of follow the Tao, follow the flow. And that flow is not an off-on digital binary thing. It has texture, has quality.
No, but it has no certainty. It's like asking the question, here's a thermometer, tell me when it's hot. You put your finger on this thermometer and you tell me right when it's hot. You can't, because that's exactly what you described. It's on, it's preparing to be off. Now it's off, now it's preparing. Now, when you come back over to the digital world, it's on, it's off. Oh, by the way, give me the thermometer right here, 90 degrees. When it hits 90 degrees, it's hot. Those are arbitrary, artificial reckonings of a natural system, which is beyond that kind of limited thinking.
It reminds me of the comparison of an analog waveform versus a digital waveform.
Right. Absolutely. Analog is better.
You know the symbol of the yin-yang symbol that looks like an S?
Yeah.
And I was looking at it the other day, and I was thinking, well, you got the yang and you got the yin. So there's two, and then you got the pen stage, the lose stage, and then the G stage where it's building. It decides to stop building. It's going to release, right? And they got those three states. And I kept having problems with it because it would have the three states. It would expand. It would stop expanding. Then it would release. And I was kind of having difficulty because it would end with that final state. But I was imagining it in such a way. But what I had to do was expand it out to an unending wave. Then that would make sense that that final state is actually the beginning state of the next wave. And you don't get that with digital, right?
No, that's what you were going, right, Jason? You were describing the digital versus the analog signal.
Right. An analog signal is always pictured as very smooth and curvy. And then a digital waveform is always represented very stepped stair because it's taking snapshots, digital points in time.
And the analog's unending. It just keeps going like that wave in the ocean that keeps moving on and on and on, right?
Well, it's almost like the digital version of that waveform that Jason just described is meant to be edited. I can cut from here to here and easily paste it right from here to here. When you go to the analog, it's an intrusion to do that. It can be done, but it's not the same. It's almost like the digital version was meant to be piecemealed any which way you want it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think we're coming up at the top of the first hour. Jason, do you want to get anything more in before I start wrapping up here?
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing more about the actual creation story. I like the way you set it up with the description of the energy, but the energy hadn't yet begun its actual state of creation.
Right.
Or speaking the word, if you want to look at it from a more Christian context.
Yes, it was aware, but not actualized.
Well, there's three things we just talked about, the waveform, the energy, and the consciousness behind it. In the beginning was the word. All right. Do you want to offer anything out in terms of contact or website before I wrap up hour one? We take a short break, Stephen?
Well, I would think that. Again, the NSTCMA site on Facebook is a good place to start. And people are more than welcome to pop in there, ask questions. There's videos there. There's content that they can find. And they can, if they want to hit me, they can hit me there.
All right. Well, that is hour one. I'm going to wrap up, guys. We're going to take a short break, come back for hour two. But that is, in fact, the top of hour one of 609, episode 609 with Stephen D. Oliver. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. Members get access to all the forums, threads, and comments. They can create all those things. They can also stream the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon anytime they want from the site. It has 10 awards in the world, last two coming from India. It's got all lunar waves, weird, weird UFOs, chemtrail orbs, invisible things that were shot in full spectrum. It's got all kinds of things, but it also contains the first time I found the binary to our sun, or what I suspect is the binary to our sun. With that, I hope to see everyone logged in as a member, and we're going to take a quick 5-minute break and we'll be back for hour two. I want to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
belief is the enemy of knowing.